From the City of Angels near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Spring has arrived as the year is rolling along. Later tonight, the life of mobster Johnny Roselli, they called him Handsome Johnny, author Lee Server joins us. Here's what's happening. Justice Department prosecutors have issued multiple subpoenas as part of a criminal investigation now into Boeing's Federal Aviation Administration certification and the marketing of the 737 MAX planes. The criminal investigation, which is in its very early stages, began after the October 2018 crash of a 737 MAX aircraft operated by Lion Air in Indonesia. 189 people died in that crash. The Transportation Secretary asked for the agency's Inspector General to investigate the certification. Criminal investigators have sought information from Boeing on safety and certification procedures, including training manuals for pilots, along with how the company marketed the new aircraft. We'll see how this unfolds. New Zealand's Prime Minister has said that all military-style semi-automatic weapons, assault rifles, high-capacity magazines will be banned in the country following that mass shooting at two mosques that killed 50 people. If you look up in the sky today, you're going to see an incredible full worm moon. It's a supermoon, and it is the third and final supermoon of this year, but it is gorgeous if you get a chance to take a quick peek. Talking about the full moon in Alexandria, Virginia, defense attorneys say a man accused of brutally stabbing a man to death in Alexandria last July did so because he thought the victim was a werewolf. About 70% of the fresh produce sold in the United States has pesticide residual on it, even after it has been washed, according to health advocacy groups. According to the Environmental Working Group's analysis of the U.S. Department of Agriculture data, strawberries, spinach, and kale are among the most pesticide-heavy produce, while avocados, sweet corn, and pineapples had the lowest level of this stuff. Let's check in with our food safety coach, Jeff Nelkin. Jeff, first of all, we had a story yesterday about the glyphosate from Monsanto, which is in Roundup, that it causes cancer. Could this be part of the problem here?
I think the issue, you know, of identification of this chemical in relationship to how it's being applied is something that has to be, again, you know, re-examined. And originally when they did the research, you know, was it done, you know, correctly? And if it's been, you know, altered or if it was exaggerated, there needs to be, you know, an investigation as to why, you know, the research was, you know, tainted.
And they say now, you know, even wash the produce, you're not going to wash these pesticides and residue off.
Well, again, you know, a lot of the residue, you know, adheres, you know, to the product. And, you know, think about, you know, the structure of, you know, strawberries and various fruits the chemicals adhere to. My concern is that there needs to be, you know, further study and investigation to application of these chemicals. These chemicals are being used by people. Have they been trained how to use them? You know, to use the application of the chemicals. I think there needs to be a review of the handling of these chemicals, and there needs to be further you know, research into why these chemicals are being used and the quantities that they're being used, and that maybe the environment, you know, is changing as well. And I think we need to, you know, re-examine, you know, all the efficacy of how these chemicals are applied.
Hey, Jeff, if you're at home listening to this program right now and someone says, well, I love strawberries and spinach and kale, and they're the top three on the list, what do I do? What do they do?
The point is, you know, again, to wash our fruits
as much as you can, I guess.
Yeah, when I say wash, we're talking about immersing in water, not using soap or any chemicals, you know, to break it, you know, break off these items. And, you know, we're talking about very, very minuscule amounts of the chemical. So, you know, the argument has always been, you know, the chemicals are supposed to be used to a safe level. And now the question is going to be, you know, how do they redefine those safe levels?
Good point. Jeff, thank you. Jeff's website, foodsafetycoach.com. Smoking potent cannabis increases your risk of serious mental health now, according to researchers. They estimate that around 1 in 10 new cases of psychosis may be associated with strong cannabis. Now, this is based on their study of European cities and towns. Two San Francisco officials have proposed a new law there that would ban the sale of e-cigarettes in the city until the Food and Drug Administration conducts a review to evaluate its effect on public health. Finland has been crowned the happiest country in the world for the second year in a row, leading a top 10 that is made up of five Nordic nations. The World Happiness Report, released today, ranked 156 countries by happiness levels based on factors such as life expectancy, social support, and corruption. Canada was number 9 on the list. The United States was 19. Interesting take there. I mean, what's it take to be happy anyway? Our story in the news at coasttocoastam.com. You've got to look at this picture. A little 13-year-old boy from Texas caught a catfish. This thing is 67 pounds and is as big as he is. He's holding it. It's huge. Catfish. He'll be eating that for the next 20 years. Well, the annual Templeton Prize, which recognizes outstanding contributions to affirming life's spiritual dimension, has been awarded to a Brazilian theoretical physicist dedicated to demonstrating that science and religion are not enemies. Marcelo Gleiser, a physics and astronomy professor whose specializations include cosmology, he's 60 years old, has now been in the United States since 1986. He said he's an agnostic, he does not believe in God, but refuses to write off the possibility of God's existence completely. Damn, to me it sounds like, you know what, he may get his answer. Speaking of answers, it's called Elastic, Flexible Thinking in a Time of Change. Leonard Mlodinow joins me next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. Our special guest for the next couple hours, Dr. Leonard Mlodinow, is a theoretical physicist, noted author, was on the faculty of the California Institute of Technology. His most recent book is called Elastic. Just came out. Unlocking Your Brain's Ability to Embrace Change is about how you can become more innovative and creative. Now, the book is a sequel to his bestseller, Subliminal, How Your Unconscious Mind Rules Your Behavior. Now, he has also co-authored the number one bestseller, The Grand Design, with the late Stephen Hawking, and also with Deepak Chopra of War of the World Views, Science and Spirituality. In addition, Leonard has written for the series MacGyver and Star Trek The Next Generation. He was last on with me the day after physicist Stephen Hawking died last March. And it's been a year, Leonard. Welcome back, my friend.
Thank you. Good to be back. Sad anniversary, though.
It really is. You must miss him. You two were very close.
Yeah, he was. Even though he was sick for so many years, you always thought that he'd outlive you.
He really went beyond what people thought he would do.
He had so many close calls in and out of the hospital all the time. So many times, everyone thought this was going to be it, and then he would just bounce back. It just seemed he seemed immortal.
Yeah, I just had that story of that physicist who was given an award who's an agnostic, which means he's looking for proof that God exists. I think you and I talked when your books came out together, the bestseller, The Grand Design. He was a believer in God, wasn't he?
Well, I wouldn't say that, but I think he had pretty much the attitude of the fellow you mentioned, and you could say he believed in a kind of God, but to him that, you know, it wasn't the God of the Bible. It was the fact that something had to, you know, well, that there's laws of physics that everything follows, and where do they come from? And he would say, if you want to call that God, that's fine. It's just a name, but not really the God that kind of watches over you and makes sure your kid wins the Little League game or anything like that.
Your latest book, Elastic, came out in January of this year, brand new. Tell us a little bit about it.
Well, human thinking can be put on a spectrum. At one end is logical, analytical reasoning, and that's what most of us grow up being, having pounded into us that, you know, in school, be logical, follow the rules of reasoning, the SAT tests for it, and employers look for it. And that's really works really well when you're facing a situation you've seen before where the framework is there for you. You know what your goals are. You know what your assumptions are. And you just follow along, A, B, C, D, get to the answer. But in today's world, you know, ever more, we're facing new situations or situations that have changed. And in that case, you need the other end of your thinking. That's elastic thinking. Elastic thinking is the kind of thinking that you use to look at a new or changed situation and set up a framework for how to attack it. What are your assumptions? What are your goals? How do you approach it? And how do you get ideas? And it's about generating the ideas that you need to set that up and to look at it in a different way. And it's only when you have all that done that you can even use logical thinking. I'm not saying logical thinking isn't useful, but we focus far too much on it. We need to learn how to think elastically, to let go of comfortable ideas and rise above conventional mindsets and to frame and reframe questions. And especially today, as I said, because the society is changing much faster than ever before.
Does everyone have the ability to utilize elastic thinking?
Oh, yeah. In fact, it's one of the key characteristics of the human species. It saved us, I'm sure, many times, but one time that's been documented, it was about 100,000 years ago when there was a great, guess what, climactic change
that wiped
out most of the human race. And those that survived were the ones that were more exploratory, loved new things, that had like more resources at their fingertips because they had looked around more and they had been more adventurous. And since they survived and the others died out, this was a kind of a genetic filter that really punched up the amount of elastic thinking in our ability in our genes. And ever since then, we've been exploring all over the earth. You know, human beings have spread everywhere, and we've, you know, been great innovators and storytellers and had an amazing degree ability for innovation and imagination. So we can all do it. But of course, within the species, we have a different levels. You know, everyone has different abilities. And in Elastic, I give some tests that you can test yourself in long different dimensions. And the good news is you can do exercises and practice and improve yourself just as you can in logical, analytical thinking or your knowledge in general. You can, if you're mindful of the kinds of elastic thinking elements that you need, you can improve that in yourself and end up a more elastic thinker.
Will it benefit you if you use this a lot as an individual?
Oh, sure. Look at all the challenges that we have today in our lives
every day.
You know, you were just mentioning, when just hear the news and all the crazy things that we're faced with today are, I mean, little like, okay, last holiday season, I'm online trying to order some gifts, and this is really crazy. You go to a website. It wasn't Amazon. It was not, you know, famous website, but I went to commerce website, found something that I liked there, and I was giving my credit card. I was going to order it, and then I noticed something in the URL that looked funny, and I stopped. I opened another browser, did some research, and found that this was some famous site that cheats you, that takes
steal your card.
They charge, they take your money, they don't send anything. And how do you, my 10, 20 years ago, we didn't have to face all these kinds of things in our lives. And today, every day, there's new kinds of challenges that we have to face. And so you need elastic thinking for that to get creative. And you have to be as smart and creative as the people, you know, on the other side.
You're really telling it spot on, because so many of these phony websites are out there, and then in a lot of them, they somehow find you, and you get an email from them. You open it up, and you've created a problem, a mess.
Yeah, it is. Email is another place where you have to be very careful, and thank God that most of the people who seem to do these attacks are not good at English. I know they often have a grammatical error, and I go, wait a minute, Google wouldn't make that mistake. Is it really Google?
Leonard, do you get robocalls on your cell phone?
Oh, my. my God, yes.
Me too. I get. Yeah. I must get 8 to 10 a day, and first of all, I rarely answer them, but once in a while I will to try to harass them, and the computer starts talking to you in a female or male voice, and you think they're human because you say hello, hello, and it just keeps on and on, and then it stops, and then they try to get more information from you electronically. It's crazy.
Yeah, it is, and it's very frustrating. And I wish that Congress would do something about it. I guess it's not that easy, but I think it's a big pest that we all have to face, right? We all get, I'm sure, 5 or 10 a day of that sort. You try blocking it, but now they can generate new numbers.
They get new numbers almost instantly. Where do they get them?
You have to admire that part. They are elastic thinkers. See, we have to use it for the good, but there are people who are going to use it for the bad.
That's right.
In your life, examine your life, whatever you're doing. There's always room to innovate and today everyone is doing that. And in business, it's crazy. Your business 50 years ago, the lifespan of a business was about 50, 60 years, a Fortune 500 business, and today it's 20 years. So businesses are falling off right and left because they're getting challenges from other businesses that are really more innovative or have VC money or global connections. And in your life, it's the same thing. We have to keep up.
Who are these people behind these robocall companies? Who are these people?
I don't know, but I think they're generally offshore, so they're not.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, to get to, and they have they can come in, and it's gotten pretty sophisticated, so it's not we don't necessarily even have jurisdiction, but there have to be ways to to stop it. I'm not sure what, and there are apps you can get, I think, out there that I've heard about that will filter.
We'll stop that filter it. Yeah.
Yeah, then, my life is getting so complicated, so I want another app for,
Yeah.
I just don't answer the calls if they're not in my phone book generally, right?
I know, but what a pain, to be sure. And a lot of people now are starting to get, I'm not going to do it, computer chips embedded in their hands and in their bodies.
You're right, and so far that's used mainly for identification. So, it's become a big thing because of all the identity theft and all the fraud, that you'd be able to identify yourself, and you go to the bank and they check 25 different things, take your fingerprint, your DNA, I don't know. But now you have a chip that would be able to do that. But they're thinking of making that chip also, giving it other capabilities so that you can pay for things, for instance, where you just put your hand there and the chip will charge.
What do you do if the crook kidnaps you and cuts it out of you or something?
I don't know, but what do you do with any crook? You hope they catch them, but it's a little scary. But on the broader issue of AI, that's a really interesting question because, with regard to elastic thinking, traditional computer programs have always been non-elastic. They've been algorithmic, logical, analytical. There's a set of rules. There's a recipe called the program, right? That it follows, and you put in data, it churns through, and it gives you conclusions. And because of that, the computers have not been creative at all or innovative. They can, they can do things that seem creative or artistic. They can, for instance, compose music, but it's music in the style of Mozart or somebody else, and it's been programmed to generate variations on that. That's not real art. But lately, and this is where things are going to really get interesting and maybe scary, they've been making computers that execute elastic thinking. That's the using neural networks, they call them, and with so-called deep learning, where the computers are not following a program. They're kind of has a lot of small parts that are interacting and evolving a strategy that's not given to them by the programmers. And when they figure out, when the computer figures out how to do it, the program doesn't even know what it's doing.
Gosh.
They can beat us in chess and Go, and they're going to be running our cars soon.
And they make up their own minds, basically.
They make up their own minds. Now, I'm not a believer in the singularity that they're going to take over in 2030 or anything like that, because they're all designed in a certain realm. This one plays chess or Go or drives your car, but they can now learn and figure out for themselves the best strategies, which is an amazing, enormous advance. And it's really elastic thinking, and they could never do that before. It just started in the last few years, and it's... Now programmers who know how to do that, they can make $1 million. I mean, it's crazy. The salaries have skyrocketed.
Stick with us, Leonard. We're going to take a quick break. Elastic, flexible thinking in a time of change. Leonard Mlodinow's website is linked up at coasttocoastam.com. We're going to come back and talk more next hour. We've got him for one more hour. Next hour, we'll take phone calls as well. And welcome back. We are with the scientist, theoretical physicist Leonard Mlodinow. Leonard, what's new in the world of science, by the way, before we get back into Elastic? Any cutting-edge breakthroughs out there?
Well, you know, the big one was the gravitational waves that I think was really the biggest breakthrough of the, in physics at least.
It kind of backed up Einstein, didn't it?
Well, it's that, yeah, it definitely did. And it was, 100 years after his prediction that it was confirmed. But it's really the beginning of a new way to examine the universe because, since Galileo, we've been using telescopes to look at light and then different frequencies, radio waves, infrared, and microwaves. So they're all different kinds of light that we've been using to study the other galaxies in the past because the light takes a while to get to us, so we can look backward that way. But with gravitational energy is a totally different kind of energy than electromagnetic or light energy. And so this success opens up a whole new way to study the universe, and we can learn things that we couldn't learn using light methodology or electromagnetic methodology. So it's not just that we confirmed what Einstein predicted, but that we opened up a whole new way of studying the cosmos, and that's pretty exciting, I think.
When you were dealing with Stephen, did he try to explain to you his thoughts on the Big Bang and started?
Of course he did. Yeah. And that was what consumed his life, were those ideas. And
did he get his answer? Did he find it?
He had his answer. And that's really what our book, The Grand Design, was about. You want it, George?
I want it. I want it.
So
that song in Queen, I want it now.
Okay, well, the universe is expanding, right? With time, it's getting bigger. So that means not that you and I are expanding, but that the space that we're in is expanding. So between two points in space, there's more and more space as time goes on. And if you go backwards and run that backwards, you'll find that the universe was smaller in the old days. And when the universe gets small enough, it enters what's called the quantum realm. The quantum realm is a realm where, of the very tiny, where the uncertainty principle and all that craziness from quantum mechanics is relevant, and where things are bubbling in and out of existence all the time, and you can't say where something is because it could be here, it could be there, and all those crazy things that happen normally just on the atomic or nuclear scale, that they would happen on the whole universe scale when the universe was small enough. So as you go backward, the effect of that on space and time itself starts to be noticeable, so that space and time lose the character that we understand that they have today, that we feel that we intuitively understand, and time begins to look more like a dimension of space. That was his theory, and that if you go back, there is no point which is a beginning, because time itself ceases to have the meaning that we normally assign to it. It's almost like, think about the globe. If you're starting somewhere on a globe, you start heading south, you never really find the beginning. You can go through the South Pole and you start coming back north, but you never find a point where it starts or ends. It just goes in circles. So that's kind of the idea that he had of how the universe began. And it was a quantum beginning, which means that there are many, many alternative universes, just like there are many different places mm-hmm. an electron can be. There are many different histories the universe could have. And, of course, we're in one particular one of them. And so that his view was that the different parallel universes all have different laws of nature, that the laws of nature themselves are what we in physics can call a dynamical variable. They're like a property, like position or speed. The laws themselves are determined by these quantum fluctuations. And so all the different universes have different laws. And we happen to be in one that has laws that allow us to be here, but that's not hard to understand, because if this universe didn't have those laws, we wouldn't be here to ask about it, right?
That's right. That's right. Does it prove or disapprove of the existence of God?
Well, see, when we wrote that book, it was very controversial. The London Times kicked us off with a big headline, Stephen Hawking, colon, there is no God, or something like
that. And that wasn't true.
No, it's not true at all. You know, we don't, we're not at all proving that there is no, what his theory says is that you don't need a deity or anything else to start the universe, that the universe could come from nothing. And it explains how that works. That doesn't mean that there isn't one. And, of course, one, as we said earlier, one could always ask the question, well, who made the quantum laws? You know, in physics, you can always, whatever your my answer is as a physicist, you can say, but why is that, right? I'll say it's because of this theory, the theory that A equals B, and I derive everything from it. He says, well, why does A equal B? And maybe if I work hard, I'll find out because C equals D, and then you can say, why does C equal D? There's no end to it. So the end is, by definition, God, you know, in some people's
right.
minds, and that was Stephen's view.
Have we been able to explain scientifically what life is all about?
No.
I mean, here you are. You're on this.
Yeah.
You're on this national radio show. You've had your life. I've had mine. We've got all these billions of people scurrying around the planet. What's it all about?
Well, I think we each have to find, you know, our own meaning. To me, learning about my place and the place of, well, my personal place, the place of my species and my planet in the universe, and where it's going, that gives it the meaning that it has. It allows me to put myself in perspective, and, you know, not take myself too seriously.
Mm-hmm.
But see, you know, on the other hand, how wonderful it is that, you know, laws that are basically governed by randomness can produce something that is so unrandom as you and I, and you know, such a rich consciousness and ideas and existence. And that's just a wonderful miracle that happens. And to understand that, it just, you know, some days you may go, my troubles are bad, and you go, not compared to the stars, or I'm great, not compared to the galaxy. So I think that keeping all that in mind and where you fit is a very healthy thing.
I think what's interesting about your title, Elastic, is the subtitle, Flexible Thinking at a Time of Change. Flexible thinking, I think, is very important for somebody in their life, isn't it?
It is. I think it's very important, not only for success and to thrive and to face new challenges, but just to be happy. If you're not flexible and things happen that you don't like or you didn't expect, it causes psychological problems, issues. You get upset. If you're flexible and go with the flow, it's better. That's where Deepak and science come together, because he always used to tell me that, Leonard, being flexible is the most important thing. And
yeah, he might be right.
I think he's right. Course, by the way, can I give out my Twitter?
Oh, absolutely. Sure thing.
El Melodno. It's at El Melodno.
You better spell that.
Yeah, okay. At LMLODINOW. L for Leonard, and then MLODINOW. Thanks.
All right.
George.
Absolutely. We'll give it out again before you're off the air with us tonight. A lot of corporations are changing their approach now to increase performance. And one of the ways they're doing this is through what you're writing about right now, elastic thinking.
Right. Well, you know, they've noticed that you have companies like Kodak. Remember Kodak? Great company, invented digital photos.
Well, what happened to them?
Defunct. You know, what about Blockbuster? Blockbuster.
Oh, that. I was talking about that last week. They didn't see it coming at all.
Well, they didn't have the flexible thing. I'll tell you, you know.
Some executive, Leonard, should have said, folks, there's something called streaming video, which is going to make all our stuff and stores obsolete. There's one Blockbuster store left. I think it's in Australia, and it's owned by some franchisee. All the company stores are gone. The business is gone, basically.
Business is gone. Well, they had the clunky tapes, right? They're even slow to get into the DVDs, and Netflix starts mailing them, and they thought, oh, that's dorky, they're mailing DVDs, but guess what? That was a great business, and Blockbuster was even slow in putting them in their stores.
Publicly held company at the time.
You know, and that's why Netflix is a great example, because Netflix kind of started pushing them away with the DVD mailings, right?
Yep. Netflix killed them.
Yeah, that's right. But then when the streaming started, as you just pointed out, Netflix was not like Blockbuster. Netflix started saying, these DVDs are nice, but, you know, that's going to go by the wayside, too. Let's get on to the new business. And they started looking at streaming. And people criticized them in the beginning, like, oh, they're going into streaming. Streaming is clunky. You know, we don't have the bandwidth yet. And they said, no, streaming is the future. So they did what Blockbuster didn't do. They made the transition, and they're still trying to keep continually, and that's what you have to do today.
Now, when the power goes down or something goes down, you might want to have your DVDs still around, but that's...
Apparently, there's still a little mail order business. I didn't realize that Netflix does. Some people...
Just in case. Yeah, some people are still the dinosaur type. But, I mean, here's somebody at Blockbuster, some executive who did not see this coming, and Netflix blew right past them. How could they miss that?
That's... thing, you know, people are not used to questioning their assumptions. So they had to remember in the old days the secret of business was to look at your core business. Remember those words they used to say, core business? You look at your core business, stick to your core business, focus on it, optimize it. And that's not true anymore. If they stuck to their core business, and they got core business right out of business. So, you know, now you've got to constantly be changing your business.
I bet some young executive, some kid who was working at Blockbuster went to talk to his executive boss and said, boss, you know, I think there's this new thing coming where people are going to be able to watch, and they're not going to have to leave their home to get the DVD. They can just do it with their remote right on their television because it's all going to be that way. And he said, I don't even know what it's called, but we should look into that. And the guy probably said, you're nuts, kid. Go back to your office.
I bet there are Blockbuster employees who quit and went to work for Netflix and did quite well for themselves.
Yeah, absolutely.
But, you know, my favorite is, okay, guess what this company is? They don't pay their workers. They don't train their workers. They don't do quality assurance on their stuff, even though it's supposed to be experts. Guess what? Those are all assumptions that you would think that would, you know, imagine going to a grocery store and they say, oh, not only not pay, they don't charge either. So imagine you go to the grocery store, they say, take what you want, pay what you want. Okay, that's the business model of this company. Wikipedia. Okay, so imagine Britannica. I remember Encyclopedia Britannica, you know, when the online stuff started happening, people said, oh, yeah, they're going to put their encyclopedia online too. But that's not, it wasn't online encyclopedia that was Wikipedia's great vision. It was these things that I said, that they're going to have the people write it, and they're not going to get paid, and they're not going to be
employees.
We're not going to charge for it, and they're not going to be trained, and it's all going to work out by the wisdom of crowds. And it was that assumption that Britannica couldn't stand it.
And they'll also let non-paid public members correct the mistakes.
Yeah, they correct. So just like you said, there's probably people at, you know, Britannica who are saying, hey, we gotta co-opt this Wikipedia company. We gotta start doing what they're doing. They're, oh, that'll never work. You know, who remember they were saying up until a few years ago, an encyclopedia that's not written by experts. How could that be?
Well, could you then call elastic thinking futuristic thinking as well?
It is futuristic. It's the kind of thinking that envisions and prepares for the future. And it's what you need. It's what you need to face the future, because in the future, things aren't going to be the way they are today. If you look back, imagine you go on a vacation 20 years ago. You didn't go to all these different websites. You didn't go to Airbnb. You didn't get to the airport by Uber. Everything has changed, right? So 20 years from now, it's going to change also. And to keep up with it and to be... to deal with it, you need elastic thinking.
Is elastic thinking the wave of the future for an individual?
More and more. And I'm not saying I have to be careful to stress that I'm not saying logical thinking doesn't have a place. It really does. But more and more we need elastic thinking. We need a mix of thinking, and our brains are capable of both. But what we need more and more, and what has been neglected in the past, except if you're an artist or a writer or a musician, is a need for elastic thinking. But we need it now in business, and we need it in our everyday lives.
Would you say that Jeff Bezos from Amazon, Elon Musk from Tesla, PayPal, of course, that they were elastic thinkers?
Oh, yeah.
And still are.
Exactly. They're the ones who are the anti-blockbusters and the opposites. Like,
right.
Anti, as a physicist, the opposite of Blockbuster, the opposite of Britannica. They were the ones who questioned, who had a vision that things could work differently. And, you know, when you first have that vision, that looks weird. So when I just said you might go into a grocery store and pay what take what you want and pay what you want, ha-ha, we're all laughing. But if someone started a grocery store like that, it might work. And then 20 years from now, we'd look back and go, I can't imagine how it was any different. You know, the idea that you take your own groceries and put them into a grocery cart was a new idea at one time, about 100 years ago. People used to go in, and someone behind the counter would have to hand them their groceries. And the business was very inefficient because there were long waits when there was crowded, and when it was not crowded, they had a lot of clerks sitting around doing nothing. Someone had this idea that to do it differently, the way we do it now, right? And people laughed at him and said, that's not going to work. You can't let people touch the stuff themselves. How are you going to organize that? And he figured, I have cash registers and lines and aisles of stuff. And he started what's called Piggly Wiggly, which is still around. He became
that's right.
a multi-millionaire. And at that time, though, when he started, it was just as weird an idea as we'll let people take what they want and pay what they want. It's just as weird as the Wikipedia one. But 20 years after he, you know, his store started and other stores started up that way, people couldn't imagine how they ever did it differently. That's just the way ideas go.
It is dramatic. Now, how do you train someone to start thinking that way when maybe they were too rigid in the first place?
Well, so there are different dimensions or aspects of elastic thinking that I talk about. Neophilia is kind of the love of the new.
Neophilia, that sounds like something illegal for
crying. Or fun. But yeah, it means love of the new, and it is. It's how adventurous are you, and that's important. And mindfulness, how well do you understand what your own ideas and come from and your own feelings? Schizotypy is how original are your ideas. So I have a bunch of questionnaires, the psychologists call them inventories, where you can see where you stand on the spectrum of average or above and below average people, and then there's different exercises that you can do. And then there's a few basic principles that you should try to follow, like try to get rid of a fear of failure, for example. A fear of failure is very bad for elastic thinking.
Nothing wrong with failing, as long as you learn from it.
That's right. Well, you see, your mind is constantly generating new ideas. You know, you have as many new ideas as Picasso or Elon Musk or Tesla. They're all in your unconscious mind.
And if you're afraid to utilize it, it's not going to happen for you.
Well, they don't even come to your consciousness because your brain keeps them out. There's too many for you to deal with, so your brain filters them out. That's just the ones that are most promising, which usually means most conventional, to come through.
Hold on for a second, Leonard. We're at the top of the hour. We will come back and talk more about your work, Elastic, Flexible Thinking in a Time of Change. His website linked up at coasttocoastam.com. And we will flip the switch and take your calls with Leonard as well on Coast to Coast AM.